If you have your Bibles, please turn to Luke 10. This will be our jumping off spot. I would consider this lesson to almost be a repeat of last night's lesson. Because a lot of times I think about the two things together. And it's basically the same message with some different details. So I'm going to do this as reinforcement, and then we'll do a contextual study later on. Basically, when I teach out of the Bible, I look for two things. I either do narratives or I do contextual studies. A narrative is a story. You have who, what, when, where, and how. A contextual study is you've got a biblical author writing a church audience solving a problem. And the problem that he solves is going to be based in two things. It's first going to be based in theology, how you think. And then once he gets the thought process in place, he's gonna say, if you take those attitudes and apply them to this problem, you'll solve it. That's called task theology. But whether you study context or whether you study the narrative, I look for three things when I study the Bible: facts, concepts, and application. The facts are who, what, when, where, how big, how small, how many. Who wrote it? When was it written? What setting was he writing to? Those are your facts. Your concepts are the things that never change. They're just as true when David fought Goliath as they are now. And then the application is, how can I use those things? So when I study the Bible, I'm looking for three things: fact, concept, and application. And we're going to do that with this context. But before we get to the context I want to talk about, I thought we'd use this as kind of a jumping off point. Luke chapter 10, start about verse 38. Now it happened, as they entered a certain village, a certain woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. She had a sister called Mary, who also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. But Martha was distracted with much serving and approached him and said, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Therefore, tell her to help me." And Jesus answered and said, "Martha, Martha, you are worried and troubled about many things, but one thing is needed, and Mary has chosen the good part, which will not be taken away from her." You have these two sisters, Mary and Martha. They live in the little town of Bethany. Bethany's on what I consider to be the backside. It's probably the eastern slope of the Mount of Olives. Mount of Olives sits next to Jerusalem, on an opposite hill with the Kidron Valley in between. If you go all the way to the top of the Mount of Olives, there's a place there called Gethsemane. It's often translated as the olive press, sometimes called the crushing place. It's where they crushed olives to get olive oil out of them. And you go just outside that little garden and down the slope of the hill, and there's Bethany, a little town on the Mount of Olives, and that's where Mary and Martha live. Well, Jesus goes to their house. And apparently Jesus went to their house to teach, because he's sitting in a room with Mary and he's talking about stuff. What's Martha doing? What's Martha doing? And how's she feel about all this? She hates it. Okay, you have a visiting preacher. He shows up, and what do you have to do to the visiting preacher? You must feed him. Somewhere written in the Bible, where two or three are gathered together, there we eat, you know. And you have to feed the guy, right? And so the visiting preacher's in town, and she's got to feed him. Listen to how the Bible describes what she's doing. Martha was distracted with much serving. Have you ever noticed that sometimes in churches we program our people to death? This means yes in Alabama. This means no. This means you're not voting. Have you ever noticed that sometimes in our churches we have so many programs that we get distracted by what we do? Yes. Have you ever been involved in one of those programs and you were quote unquote serving the Lord? I mean, that's what Martha thinks she's doing. She's serving the Lord. Literally, he's at her house and she's serving him. She is serving the Lord, and yet she's frustrated. Not only is she frustrated, she's angry. She's not only angry at her sister, she sort of gets sideways with the Lord here. I mean, she's fussing at the Lord himself. You ever been involved in a program and got frustrated at the brethren? And then got frustrated at the Lord? All right, we're all going to get together and have a water fight at church. 900 people show up. We're going to get together and stack chairs and move tables, getting ready for the gospel meeting, and four people show up. We're going to get together at the church and we're going to go door knocking. Two people shows up. One guy finds out you're door knocking. He pretends to be sick. I'm allergic, you know, and he goes home. And then you're out here doing, quote unquote, service for the Lord. And you start, man, nobody's here to help me. Lord, how come you didn't lay that road? We're mad at our brethren. We're mad at the Lord. Am I the only person ever experienced that? I'd like to talk a little bit about a different, and it's probably not different, but a not preached about often enough method of evangelism. Based on this thing, that sometimes we talk about evangelism and I'm told how I have to do it. And the way we seem to approach it is counterintuitive. It doesn't work very well. It doesn't fit naturally. You know, how many times you brought your Bible to school and tried to have a Bible study at lunch? I'm not even sure you can take a Bible to school anymore. I think you still can in Alabama. You know, and how does that work out? It ends up being an argument. It ends up being a debate. Just to explore some things. Look at the book of Ephesians. If you set the book of Ephesians in context, the writer of the book of Ephesians is going to do some real interesting stuff. Paul will always write his letters in two sections. He'll write an indicative, and then he'll write an imperative. Basically, he's going to give you, hey, these are some things you need to know, and if you know these things and you adopt this thought process, then there's some things you have to do about that once you get that in your mind. For instance, if I gave you these indicatives, lights are flashing in the hallway, smoke is coming from the vents, there's a fire alarm going off. Those are all the indicatives. Now, if I told you those things were true, and you believe me, I would say, therefore, we must all get up and exit the building calmly. Indicative versus imperative. How many times have you heard a preacher preach from a letter from Paul, and the first thing he said in his sermon was, therefore? I mean, that stuff will preach. But the therefore is not good without the indicatives. The therefore is there for a reason. That's why it's therefore. Okay? I'm glad you got that. Somebody is awake. All right? So what happens in the book of Ephesians is Paul is going to talk about the absolute nature of the church. In Ephesians chapter 1, you'll find phrases like God predestined and God determined and God chose and according to His purpose and according to the purpose of His will. And the entire first chapter of Ephesians talks about that God has an agenda. There's something God wants to accomplish on the earth. Now, when you read the Bible, and especially if you use the 1611 King James Version and you run into that term predestined, please, when you read the term predestined, let your mind go predetermined. Okay, when you read predestined, don't think in Calvinistic terms, just go predetermined. Okay, God predetermined that if these antecedent circumstances took place, these things would happen. I was married 25 years two Christmases ago. For your 25th anniversary, it works just like the wedding. Your wife tells you what will happen, and it does. Okay? So for those of you who don't know that yet, that's the way it will work for your 25th anniversary. So my wife decides that we, to celebrate our 25th anniversary, need to go see a volcano. There are not many in Alabama. She teaches science and wanted to see one. So there's one on an island in the middle of the Pacific. And she wants to take 14 days during deer season and go see the erupting volcano. And I love this woman like nothing else on this planet. So I said, yes, dear. I didn't see a deer in the woods after bow season. Starting about the 18th of November, weekend before Thanksgiving, I didn't see nothing walking. And I'm hunting like a madman. I'm going to lose 14 days of deer season. I've got to kill something. So I got up the day before I get on the boat to go to Hawaii. I'm in the woods. And I predetermined that if it walked by me, it was going to the house. I didn't care what it had on its head. If it walked by me, me and that ought-six is going to talk to it. I didn't make the deer come by me. I didn't force the deer to come by me, but I predetermined that anything that walked by me that morning would go to the house with me. That's what God says about salvation. I sent Jesus. Jesus died, was buried, and arose. And I predetermined that anyone who responded to that message would be one of my children. You see how predetermined and predestination is not as scary as a term as it is sometimes. And we let our denominational friends get that predestination, that Calvinism stuff working with us. So just consider it predetermined. So God predetermined some things that were going to happen. He had a purpose. He had an agenda. He had a plan. And then notice what he says here in Ephesians chapter 1, verses 22 and 23. And put all things under his feet and gave him to be head over the body, over all things, to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. Now, what does it mean to fill something all in all? One version says fulfills everything in every way. What does it mean to fill everything in every way? You ever made an ice milk jug? I guess you guys don't get a lot of freezing temperature in Florida. Of course you haven't. You take a milk jug and you fill it up with water and you freeze it. You can do this in your freezer. And then you cut it out and you have this piece of ice that's shaped just like a milk jug. It's really cool and they're fun to shoot. But you can take a glove, one of those big, huge, cool plastic gloves, and you can put it in the freezer. And you can freeze it full of water and then cut the glove out and you have this ice hand. And you can paint it and leave it laying around. It's really, really cool. People will react funny to it. When you put water in a plastic bag or in a jug, it fills everything in every way. It gets all the nooks and crannies out. God said that the thing that I'm trying to do on the earth, my plan, my predetermined will, my agenda, is accomplished in this thing called the church. And the church is the body. And the body is the church. And so everything that God wants to accomplish on the earth is only accomplished when the church does its job. And the big message in the book of Ephesians, first of all, talks about the church having unity. Because if the church doesn't have unity, God's plan doesn't get fulfilled. And the church is the body, and the body is the church, and it fulfills everything and everything. So it's very important that the church, first of all, have unity, and second of all, it's very important to understand the functionality of the church, how the church is supposed to function. And then he's going to talk about that God used the church to combine the Jews and the Gentiles, that God used the church to make out of all men one man, that God's going to use the church as a manifestation of His will and His glory. Paul says, He's made me a minister of the mystery. The mystery was that one of these days God's going to take the Jews and God's going to take the Gentiles and run them together and create a new nation, a new priesthood, a new humanity. And then when we get into Ephesians chapter 4, he does some of that therefore stuff, where he talks about how you and I are supposed to function in the church. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 1 says, I therefore, there's our word, the prisoner of the Lord. And he talks about us being unified and us walking worthy. And he talks about those seven ones, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one spirit. And he does this unified thing. And then he begins to talk about diversity in our unity, almost similar to 1 Corinthians 12, verse 7. But to each one of us, grace was given, and grace sometimes is the word that means gift, according to the measure of Christ's gift. Therefore, he says, when he ascended on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts to men. Paul is telling the local church there that God, in a victorious triumph, once he ascended, once he conquered death, he gave out presents. Now, the imagery he's using is the imagery of a conquering Roman general. When a Roman would go out and take over a city, they would come back to Rome and do like a ticker tape parade. And you'd have these guys, they'd ride down the middle of the street in their chariot, and behind him would be his army, behind him would be the slaves, and behind him would be wagon loads of stuff that they'd captured. There's an arch in Rome called the Arch of Titus. And it's got a picture of Titus on it. You know, who names this stuff? That guy's a genius. Anyway, they got a picture of Titus. He's standing in a chariot, got his foot up on the top, and he's holding a candlestick. Candlestick has seven branches. It came from the temple on Mount Moriah when in 72 AD the Romans knocked it to the ground. And he rides back into town with all this stuff, and he's holding a solid gold candlestick out, and they took his picture in stone. And it's the Arch of Titus. Well, that's the picture he's giving. Jesus is riding into town victorious. He's conquered death. He's been the sacrifice for all sins. And just like that Roman general would throw out gold and jewels and hand weapons to people and give somebody a string of horses and give somebody a bunch of slaves, as Jesus rode through town conquering, he gave gifts to men. It's interesting when you read this that most of the gifts he talks about seem to be spiritual gifts. But the principle of why he gave those gifts is very, very important. You guys understand the concept of a principal? Not the scary guy at school. But when I talk to my denominational friends, I say we do none of the Old Testament practices, but we follow all the Old Testament principles. We still do substitution sacrifice. It was Jesus, one time only. We take the Passover. It's just redefined. We do it with only unleavened bread and the fruit of the vine. But it's all the Old Testament principles, just none of the Old Testament practices. Okay? So you have some principles here that are going to be applied about why God gave gifts. So Jesus riding through in the triumphal procession, and he's giving gifts to men. Now listen at this. We're going to have to define some terms, and you're going to have to stay awake and stay with me. Verse 10. Well, let's skip down to verse 11. Giving gifts to men, and he himself gave some to be apostles, and some to be prophets, and some to be evangelists, and some to be pastors, and some to be teachers. He's giving a short list of some of the things Jesus gave out. He gave these gifts, these abilities to people. Why did he give those abilities to the early church? Listen at this phrase. Verse 12. For the equipping of the saints, for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. So, when God handed out these gifts, being an evangelist, being a pastor, being a teacher, being an apostle, being a prophet, why did he do that? There's three fours. For what? What's the first one? For, starts with E and ends with equipping. For what?
Equipping.
For equipping. Okay, what does it mean to equip? To prepare, to give equipment to. You ever try to do the job with the wrong equipment? There's an auto mechanic here. Where's my friend who's the auto mechanic that I thought was a child? He's married to Tatiana. There he is, yeah. He's an auto mechanic. He has cool tools. When we grew up, we tried to change our oil with a pair of pliers. Ask me how that went. Not well, okay? I've got a minor in art. My undergraduate degree's in Bible. I've got a minor in art. The reason I have a minor in art is because I couldn't afford the materials to get a major in art. I was turning in my drawings on the back of computer paper I took from the Bible building when I was a janitor cleaning up in the Bible building at Harding. And when I got that list of, here's the $300 you have to spend to buy paints and paint brushes and paint tubes and easels and stuff, I just dropped the class and changed my major. I just couldn't afford it. You can't do work without the right equipment. God says, I've given gifts to you for, number one, the equipping, to give you equipment. Now, who is he equipping? For the equipping of who? Who are the saints? Number one, not dead people. Number two, not a team in New Orleans. So who are the saints? That's us. It's the righteous. It's the people who've been redeemed. It's the people who've been saved. So God's giving gifts to the saints, so that we will have the equipment to do two things. For the work of... Now, what's ministry mean? It's not up front, out loud, wearing a tie, by the way. What's the word ministry mean? Service. And so if I take my gifts, whatever they are, and I use my gifts as equipment to do service, what will the result be? The edifying of the body of the church. Now, edification is not the process of becoming more like Ed. Okay? Edification is that biblical word that means building up. What does evangelism do? Builds up the church. All of a sudden, you've got an outline here for how to build up the church. And it says that the church is built up by people using their gifts that God gave them as equipment to do works of service. And I'm going to offer you this morning that evangelism is doing service. Kind of like David having skill and integrity as a shepherd, and you just taking the opportunities you have to do things with your talents and abilities and make a difference in people's lives. Let me share with you a quote. Vision is the opportunity. Vision is the ability to see opportunity in the present circumstances. See, sometimes we talk about the vision of the church, and we talk about if we had this, if we were there, if this is where. No. Vision is the ability to see opportunity in the present circumstances. I taught a little kid who only had one arm to rock climb, and we're teaching him how to belay. And belaying is where you use a rope to secure people as they climb. And he said, Mr. Lonnie, I need to learn to belay. And I said, well, Chris, normally you use two hands to belay. And Chris said, well, normally I just have one. And the question he asked me was, please don't tell me what people with two hands do. What can I do with the one hand I've got? That's a very significant statement. God gave you what you have so that you'd have the equipment to do works of service so you could make a difference in the church. And the difference you make in the church is build it up. And at some point when you start talking about evangelism, you've got to come to an agreement with yourself and with your elders what you consider to be church growth. And by the way, church growth is not always bigger. I hate to go Jedi Master Yoda on you, but judge me by my size, do you? And well, you should not. But if you get stronger, by default, you'll get bigger. But sometimes we get bigger without ever getting stronger. I could take you outside today and double the size of your bicep. All we have to do is find a rattlesnake. Get that dude to bite you, it'll pump right up. And you'll look like Schwarzenegger for about 48 hours, then you'll die. But you'll at least have a big pumpy arm there. And so many times we've done things in the church and we've swollen up. But that's not really growing, folks. Swelling is not growing. So he says, you've got to understand that God gave us gifts. And if you use your gifts and my gifts are different than yours and your gifts are different than mine, there's nobody here who can be as good at you as you can be. And there's nobody here who can be as good at me as I can be. And when you try to be somebody different and get out of where God put you, you're not going to be effective as an evangelist. And that's why we get like Martha and go, you know, Lord, nobody's doing any work and I'm mad at you and I'm mad at them. You have to minister in your area. Vision is the ability to see opportunity in the present circumstances. So listen to what he says. Listen to how he describes this. He gave us these equipment for the equipping of the saints, for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. Verse 13, till we all come to a unity of faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Now what he says here is, if I use my equipment and you use your equipment and we use that equipment to do works of service, three things will happen. Number one, we'll have unity of faith. And isn't that what the book of Ephesians is about? Unity. Number two, we'll have unity of knowledge. In other words, we quit arguing about things that don't really matter and start talking about the things that do matter, and we really get focused on the main thing, that I'm using my talents, you're using your talents, and we're different, but we all have the same goal. And then we come to the measure of the fullness of the stature of Christ. Now, again, that's one of those phrases you kind of have to dissect. What stature? That's not a thing pigeons sit on in the park. That's a statue. Okay? Stature means tallness. Jesus grew in wisdom and in stature, and in favor with God. What does it mean to meet the measure of the fullness of the stature of Christ? I've got a buddy in Huntsville, Alabama, named Tony Adair. Tony is a property manager for a cluster of doctors. If you ever heard of the Blackwell Group, if they build a building, Tony puts the paint on it, Tony puts the lights in it, Tony runs security in it. Tony does everything for these doctors. Well, since these doctors have these huge multi-million dollar buildings, these doctors also have houses. And often, the ladies that the doctors are married to borrow Tony from his job and make him do stuff at their houses. So Tony calls me up, says, Lonnie, you got to help me out. Mrs. Doctor, one of the doctor's wives, has this huge tree in their yard. They live in this old, old antebellum, maybe pre-antebellum house in Huntsville. And he says, she wants a swing in this tree. He says, I know nothing about ropes. I know nothing about swings. Can you please help a brother out? So I go over to Tony's house and throw some ropes up and climb the tree, and we make this beautiful swing. Took four strands on each side of the swing and wove them together like a macrame thing so it would have a spinning spiral. And then we tied monkey's fist knots below the swing so that there's these four balls of rope underneath the swing. So you got these beautiful spirals that sit on top of these balls, and then you've got this swing. And people are always stopping at their house having their picture made in the swing. It's a pretty cool deal. Now, remember, this is a neurosurgeon's house. So his seventh grade or seven-year-old son comes out and says, "Did you make those ropes look like double helix molecules on purpose?" I said, "No, I made those ropes spin on purpose. I have no idea what a double helix molecule is. Go play some soccer." Anyway, so I'm at this house, and they take me inside the house, and it's an ancient old house. And so he said, I want to give you a tour of this house since you came and hung ropes up." And you go walking down the hallway, and there's a place in the hallway, and you can see where there's been maybe another wall built, some painting and some wallpaper, and they've got it framed. And there's a little light in there, and you can look all the way back, and probably goes back this far, and it's the original wall of the original house. And written on that wall is a straight line, looks like it's made with charcoal, and there's a little line, and it says, "In 1835, I was this tall." And it's signed Sandy. I don't know if Sandy's a little boy or a little girl, but in 1835, some little squeaky kid backed up that wall and drew a little mark and then wrote under it, "In 1835, I was this tall." And it's still there on that wall right now. The stature of Sandy is marked on that wall. And in 1835, the fullness of Sandy's stature was right there. When the church reaches the measure of the fullness of Christ, that means the church stands up against the wall and makes a mark and steps away. And Jesus stands up against the wall and makes a mark. And Jesus' mark and our mark are the same. The church looks like Jesus. What a concept. And the only way the church grows up to look like Jesus is if we become servants. When you use your talents and I use my talents as our equipment to do works of service to build up the body, we have unity of faith, we have unity of knowledge, and the church looks like Jesus because Jesus ultimately was a servant. Luke chapter 6 verse 40 says, "A disciple who's properly trained will be like his master." And if your master is a servant, the greatest thing you can ever hope to become is what? A servant. And folks, you got to understand the power of service because the church is not about impressing people. The church is about influencing people. And you influence people by service, and you serve people by using the individual talents that God has given you. So what happens then is we have unity of faith, we have unity of knowledge, and we reach the measure of the fullness of Christ. The next thing that happens when we follow this plan of evangelism, verse 14, that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men and the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting. Every time I've ever had to deal with a false doctrine, you know what that false doctrine had to deal with? Something to make the church grow. You know what it always is? It's always some kind of a gimmick. It's always some kind of a trick. You know why tricks are fun to do with children, but they're not fun to do with teenagers? Hey, look, if you're 7 or below, I'm a great magician. If you're 8 or 9, it's pretty cheesy stuff. Here's a quarter. Put it in this hand, you throw it away. Right? Everybody knows it's in this hand, right?
Wait, what?
Okay, bad illustration. All right. If you understand there's no such thing really as magic, so when I do this, you know it's not in this hand. It's in this hand right here. Right? Okay? About the fourth time you do that to somebody who's 9, they go, "It's in your other hand." That's why you never do a trick again. You always just do it once, okay? The church has been fooled by a lot of guys who come in and go, "What's this? We'll ride buses and the church will grow. What's this? We'll have drama teams and the church will grow. What's this? We'll..." And every time I've ever had to deal with a false doctrine, it's been some guy with a gimmick. By the way, if there's a machine on TV and they say, "Buy this machine, don't walk on it at all, eat what you want to, lose weight, and it will do your taxes." Don't buy that machine, it's a gimmick. P90X, will hurt your body. It's not a gimmick. It's this crazy guy that says, bring it, bring it, bring it. If I ever get my hands on him, I'm going to put him to sleep because he told me bring it for the last time, all right? I'd like to strap him to a deer and let him drag one out of Kill Mountain, me standing behind him going, bring it, bring it, bring it. But now, if you want to get physically fit, do P90X, do animalistic, do something. There's no gimmick. You get on your garage floor and you throw out those push-ups, you throw out those pull-ups. There's so many guys running around the country that says, hey, if you'll do this, if you'll act like this, if you'll change this, if you'll create that, the church will grow. No, no, no. And the church is falling for it hook, line, and sinker like a bunch of little kids watching a magician. But when I do my job and you do your job, we have unity of faith, unity of knowledge. The church looks like Jesus and we're no longer children who can be conned by these charlatans because the church is growing and I don't need your magic formula to make it grow. Guys, if you won't do push-ups and pull-ups in your garage, you won't use that machine when you buy it, and you won't go to that gym 3 days a week if you pay $50 a month to do it. But when the church is doing their push-ups and their pull-ups and doing works of service, you'll be surprised the number of people who will come and people who will come back. Because God has equipped us to do evangelism, and it's not about gimmicks, and it's not about games, and it's not about innovation. It's about us doing the everyday hard work of service type evangelism. Now look what happens. Not only will we be unity of faith, unity of knowledge, the church will be growing, we will have the fullness of the stature of the body of Christ, we'll be false doctrine proof. And then listen to this next verse. That we should no longer be children, tossed to and fro and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men and the cunning craft of deceitful plotting. But speaking the truth in love, we may grow up into all things who is the head. Once we understand what we're about, once we understand that God's given us everything we need to grow, when we do confront false doctrine, we can confront it with love. My experience with hard men, guys that do things that are difficult to do, okay? I hunt with a guy who's killed more people than he has deer, okay? I've been with guys who've been shot and shot others. I've been there when, you know, the lady went crazy and shot everybody at UAH. And our guys went in that building. I was there. Me and Jim Goins moved bodies from the school bus that went over the edge of that overpass that was on CNN. I helped clean the body up of Daniel Golden when that guy executed him in the street. And I've been around some tough guys. Being around men like that, I've discovered something in my life. You show me somebody who's acting really, really aggressive, and I'll show you somebody who's really, really scared. Because the underlying component behind most aggression is fear. So when you see a guy at school and he's thugged out and wants you to think he's bad, he's sending you a message, I'm scared. And you show me somebody who's defensive and harsh and argumentative, and he's insecure with his position because he's trying to substitute volume for content. And I'm afraid so many times in the church, we've been argumentative and harsh, not because we had the truth, but because we were scared we might not have it. And once we're doing evangelism the way evangelism is supposed to be done, once we become servants, when I run into somebody who's got a false doctrine, I can speak the truth and I can speak it in love because I'm confident. You run into somebody who's got his act together, he'd have to prove to you he's got his act together. Okay? You see the movie The Last Samurai? And the old samurai guys riding to town on their horses and everybody just kind of backs up. Walk into a restaurant with a SWAT team. It's kind of the same thing. Those guys aren't walking around flexing their muscles, yelling, hey, the SWAT team's here. They walk in laughing and talking to each other because it's dinner time and we're on break. And I get to walk in with them and the place kind of hushes out. And nobody's flexing. My daughter had surgery several weeks ago, had her tonsils out. It was on training night, so I couldn't go. I called Scott. He said, look, I can't come to training. My daughter's going to be having surgery. Where? Well, at the surgery center. When they started training that night, they ran from their training compound to the surgery center. And 10 guys run into the lobby of this hospital. Step over the chairs and hug my neck. Shake my wife's hand. How's your daughter? Oh, she's cool. She's in recovery. She goes, all right, saddle up. And they jog out. The whole place is just dead silent. Lady in the back says, who are those guys? I said, that's the local SWAT team. Why were they here? My daughter's having surgery. You didn't have to prove who the tough guys were in that room. It's very, very evident. I used to go to this little bitty church in Arkansas. And the guy who preached for them was just a gentle, oh my goodness, quiet spoken. His eyes kind of twinkled when he talked. And just the neatest guy. We all went to this picnic. We were playing volleyball and there was a creek. And the boys in Arkansas are tough. Their daddies are pipeliners. There's these four boys. Their last names were Mason. They were the front four of the high school football team. They called them the Blood because they were all blood kin. They're all related. Well, they got to talk about, let's throw brother so-and-so in the creek. And brother so-and-so, this little preacher there, said, fellas, I don't want to go in the creek. And they said, we're going to throw you in the creek whether you want to go in the creek or not. And they kind of surrounded him. And this gentle, kind minister, his face kind of changed and his shoulders kind of settled. And he widened out his stance and he said, I said I don't want to go in the creek. And everybody there who was old enough to understand decided, how about throwing this guy in the creek? It's going to be bad. And they didn't put their hands on him. And I was a young man then. I was 19 or 20. And I watched it happen and I knew something happened there that I didn't understand. When this guy moved from the church, I was helping him move. And I was showing off. I picked up a file cabinet. And when I turned it, the bottom drawer spilled out. And I was cleaning up the stuff in the bottom drawer. And I found a framed citation with a trident on it. That's the symbol of a Navy SEAL. And the documentation said that this preacher was a former SEAL operator. They had approached a beachhead. Their team had taken mortar fire. He'd evacuated wounded men from the beach and then neutralized the mortar position. That's Army speak for he crawled off in the woods and found the guy shooting the mortar and they quit. And I mean, this guy, unbelievable probably what he's seen and done in his life. He didn't have a SEAL tattoo. He didn't run around beating his chest telling everybody he's a SEAL. But when he said, boys, I'm not going in the creek, everybody there who was old enough to understand man language knew he wasn't going in the creek. He was confident with who he was. Therefore, he did not have to be mean or aggressive. Guys, when we believe we've got the truth of God, all we have to do is be confident and say, fellas, let me show you what God says. Let me show you what I believe. Let me show you why I believe it. And when we have to fight with false doctrine, it doesn't have to be a fight. It can be speaking the truth in love. So if you use your talents, and I use my talents as tools to do service, the body will grow. We have unity of faith, unity of knowledge. We look like Christ. We're immune to false doctrine. And then we have to deal with false doctrine. We can speak the truth in love because we have a position of confidence, not a position of insecurity. And then listen to what else happens. Verse 15 again, but speaking the truth in love, we may grow up into all things into Him who is the head, that is Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causing the growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. When you do your job and I do my job, we function like a body. And by the way, when the church is described in the New Testament, it's never described as an organization. It's always described as an organism. and we're knit and joined together. It's a really cool Greek word that talks about the way your sinews are tied to your muscles and your muscles are tied to your bones and your bones are connected. And it talks about this thing that when you do your job and I do my job, we cause ourselves to nourish each other and grow strong. In corporate psychology, they want us to use the word synergy. Synergy is the idea that instead of taking one and one and getting two, you take one and one and it's 11. It's like using a compound pulley system. I can take a pulley, throw it over this rafter, and make a 2-to-1 pulley system so that I can, you know, when I pull, I get a 2-to-1 advantage. You can create a compound pulley system. We did one at a rope rescue class I went to. We took 5 pulleys and made a 32-to-1 pulley advantage. In other words, for every 1 pound you pull, you get 32 pounds of efficiency. We tied this rope system to an F-250 pickup truck with the emergency brakes on, and me and one guy drug it across a parking lot using a 32-to-1 advantage pulley. God says that's the way the body works. It's not about your strength. It's not about my strength. But when we combine your talents and my talents, and you do your works of ministry and I do my works of ministry, amazing, incredible things happen because the body is knit together and we pull with each other, not against each other. And it causes the growth and the edification of the body, and we grow in love because we're doing works of service. And you take that concept and you reread Matthew 28, 19 and 20. And our translation of Matthew 28, 19 and 20 is, go and make disciples. And really, the folks who understand the Greek language tell me that that word go is not the idea of, here I am at school and I've got to leave school and go over here and do something else. That Greek word for go is an aorist participle. And a participle means that it's kind of a continuing action verb. It really should be translated, as you are going, make disciples. So your mission field is wherever you're at, whatever you're doing. And if you're not doing works of service, if you're not helping people at your school, if you're not being respectful to the teachers, if you're not the go-to guy on your team that has incredible work ethic, I'm not talking about the best athlete, I'm talking about the best character. If you're not that person who is a servant leader in your school, you really have very little chances of evangelism. Because the true aspect of evangelism is when something changes inside us so that we see people differently around us. And instead of my evangelism being, I'm going to stop what I'm doing and go over here, I understand that my evangelism is using whatever talent I have, whatever tools God has given me. And your tools are different than my tools. Your abilities are different than my abilities. But you take whatever it is you're good. Ladies, your beauty can be used to make other people feel incredible. Or you can use your beauty to make other people feel stupid and ugly. The difference between being somebody who acts like a wicked sister and somebody who really conducts yourself as a princess. Gentlemen, your strength can be used to be a bully. Or you can be a hero with that strength. Folks, your academic ability, you can use to make people feel stupid, or you can tutor people and help them feel smart. It just depends on how you use what God has given you. And all of us have something God has given us. And it's just a matter of, am I using it to serve me, or am I using it to serve God? And if I'm using it to serve God, therefore I'm going to serve others. And when I serve others, something incredible happens to the church. We have unity of faith. We have unity of knowledge. We grow up to look like Christ. We become false doctrine proof because we don't have to have these gimmicks to make the church grow. And then because we don't have to deal much with false doctrine as a real issue, we can speak the truth in love. We're not reactive. We're proactive. And the body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, causes the body to grow in love. And that's the true pattern of evangelism. And the reason the church isn't growing is because we've had these gimmicks to try to make the church grow. And we've not done what I call lifestyle evangelism. And lifestyle evangelism is the natural growth out of who you are that God predetermined. When my church acts this way, my church will get stronger. And if the church doesn't act this way, there's no way the church will grow and no way the church will get stronger. Let's pray.